Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence.
Hello, everyone. It is a late summer day, so it's great to see such a big crowd here. I'm Sumi Somaskanda. I am in for Tammy Haddad on the Washington AI Network podcast. Tammy may not be here, but she does listen. So can we get one big cheer for Tammy in the podcast? Thank you. I've done my job now. Welcome to the CTA Innovation House for a conversation about the infrastructure powering artificial intelligence. Very pleased to say my guest is Dr. Roland Busch, the global president and CEO of Siemens AG. Roland, welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast.
Thank you very much.
We are two Germans talking about technology. I promise you it's going to be exciting. Despite that, I promise. So, Roland, when people hear the word AI, you know, they have all sorts of concepts that go through their head. But you talk often about industrial AI. What is it?
Well, AI, as we know it, when it started off, it's a general purpose technology. And it surprised us because when you just ask a question, you can ask it in natural language and you get amazing results. However, when you ask something, you get an answer that can be right, that can be wrong. Sometimes it's completely wrong. It's hallucinating. So the quality is, let's say, questionable. And if you want to deploy AI technology on the shop floor, it has to be deterministic. So AI is a non-deterministic technology. And by the way, this is not a bug, it's a feature. You want to turn this technology into deterministic outcomes. So when you tell a robot to do something and you do it over and over again, you expect the same results on a shop floor and not that the robot does something the robot thinks it's the best to do. What that requires, number one, is that the models which we use today, that they are trained on industrial data. Most of the models didn't see all the industrial data yet. For example, design data, which we store in our software, which tell you how a product is designed and how it works. It is time series data, very special animal. It's videos and the like. And then once you have that, then you have to have models which are really trained in a way that you have deterministic results, meaning they do exactly what you want to do. So that means if you program a PLC, a software for an industrial controller, it has to do the job precisely as you want it to do. That's industrial AI. It has a huge potential to change the way how we work, how we design products, how we operate manufacturing sites or assets in the field. And eventually, this is the biggest way, the biggest lever to monetize all the investments which are currently spent on AI.
Which is a lot, we should say. So when you say shop floor, can you help us paint a picture? What does a shop floor look like with industrial AI?
So let's talk about a welding shop. So you're running a car manufacturing plant and you want to weld, let's say, a side door of a car. You have a robot, you want to program that robot. And what one of our products does, which is one of the first really proven AI application, we call it Eigen Engineering Agent. You tell with a prompt that I want to do this robot, a welding job for a side door of a car. What the Eigen Engineering Agent does, it reaches out for the documents, the design documents of the door, the robot controls everything what it needs. And then it starts programming the robot or the PLC in order to do the job. And then once the program is done, it runs it through the compiler to see, does it work? And if it doesn't, or it doesn't do really the job as expected, it goes over again until it really works. And then you have a chance to push the button and say, download the software, push the button, and the robot does the welding job.
How far are we away from that?
You can buy it.
There you go. You heard her from Roland Busch at Siemens.
Right. It's called Eigen Engineering Agent. It's on the market. We have more than 100 customers using it. And that's really very powerful because normally you need a trained engineer In this example, what I gave you, it takes maybe a couple of days for somebody to program and to really get the right results. Now you do that literally in minutes.
How does that fit in with the discussion on reshoring? Because there is a big push here to rebuild American manufacturing, as you know, it's a big theme here in the US. Is it real or mostly ambition? And where do US partners and allies fit into that discussion?
So if you talk about reshoring and the industries which are in focus are, let's say, pharmaceutical, a lot of investment coming here, so life science. It is semiconductors. It is even some car industries or defense, any kind of things which can think of what you need in the future. So in order to do that, obviously, you need labor, skilled labor. You need to have a higher productivity because the labor costs are higher than in low-cost countries. So what you want to do is you want to reshore, but not reshore what you offshored in the past, one-to-one, but really go with a much, much higher level of automation and digitalization. It creates new jobs. These are different jobs. And eventually, you cannot re-industrialize this country with the same kind of labor intensity which you had in the past or which you have in low-cost countries. You want to change that. And the positive news is once you re-industrialize and you do it right, you create new jobs, but you create different jobs, jobs with higher level of automation, people who are dealing with robots rather than doing handish work, repetitive handish work. But this is the only way how you can do it, I strongly believe. And in the United States, you have all the ingredients. So you have, number one, you have a lot of domain know-how. You know how to build semiconductors. You know how to build molecules, if you call it to pharmaceuticals. You have the AI technology, and you have a lot of good people to deploy it. Yet, you have to train the workforce.
And what about those partners and allies? If you're reshoring for the U.S., how does that work with some of the U.S.'s partners?
If you talk about Siemens technology, we need strong partners like Microsoft. One very strong partners of ours. It's not only that they run many data centers for us, but it's also about the AI capabilities. We need the whole stack. So that means it starts with the data centers. It needs the middleware. And the middleware is basically connection between the silicon, the GPUs, and the data. You need applications, and many applications. We are running an open system. So we have a lot of applications which come from either our customers or third parties. So it's a whole ecosystem. There's one element in it which very often we forget is whatever you talk about, manufacturing a car or let's say semiconductors or whatever you want, or even pharmaceuticals, you need the ecosystem behind. So the suppliers for components, parts which you need. This small and medium-sized enterprise layer is very often forgotten. Without that, you have no chance to re-industrialize. You cannot think about exporting everything from the outside. So you need also to talk about the small and medium-sized companies. They need to increase their digital capabilities as well.
Another component in all of this is the people, of course, the workers. If you look at surveys, a lot of Americans are certainly worried about what AI will mean for their jobs. How do you deploy industrial AI in a way that keeps the people at the center still?
Number one, AI creates jobs, and we invested in the last couple of years $1 billion in manufacturing capacities, creating new jobs. We just come from meeting with a senator from Texas. So we create in Fort Worth a new manufacturing line for medium voltage and low voltage and the like. So the point is that you have to think about AI not taking jobs away, but AI creating new jobs. In some places, jobs will be gone, repetitive jobs. Sometimes you even don't want to have them. I mean, heavy lifting of a cockpit into a car is nothing you want to do. It's anyhow replaced by robots today. You can do much, much more. But it creates new jobs because you industrialize, you bring more value added, and it creates jobs which are more geared for the capabilities of humans. In Germany, for example, where we are about to build one of the most industrialized and most automated plants in the world, we have workers which used to do labor work on the shop floor, and they're now programming robots. So,
and they had to be retrained for that?
Absolutely. We have dedicated training courses for our blue-collar workers. Some training courses, they go for a couple of weeks. Some go for 2 years. depending on what the starting point is and what they are supposed to do. And I recently had talked to one of them, and he was running through a more than 1 year training, and he's now dealing with robots. He can program robots and automate a whole cell on his own. And that's the new jobs which you see.
That sounds like a really good model for here in the U.S. as well. And Siemens has actually committed a significant amount to U.S. investment and jobs. Why bet on American manufacturing now? You seem to be thinking about that one.
Never. You know, there are geopolitical tensions. There are a lot of dependencies which countries feel uncomfortable with. It goes all the way back to critical materials, for example. It's certain components which you just can get from one place in the world or maybe two places in the same country. So there's a lot of dependencies, number one. Number two is the technology is there. I don't think if you want to reshore exactly the same kind of work, which maybe 10 or 20 years were offshored to low-cost countries, it doesn't really fit. It doesn't match. Also, the cost, if you go with the same labor intensity, you will not meet the cost. However, using technology which is there right now, which allows you to automate on a much, much higher level, that gives an opportunity to really bring back on equally or even lower cost. The next thing is think about the pharmaceutical industry. It changes from blockbusters where you have one small molecule or larger molecules, you do that over and over again, into personalized medicine. So that means you want to change the recipe very often. In the plants, how we know them, it's impossible. In the new plants, which we want to design, you can do that very quickly. So that means you design a molecule and you produce it in small capacities, and then you have an adaption for maybe sometimes for individuals and produce it in another one. These are opportunities which you have, you didn't have in the past, but you can bring it now. It holds true also for food and beverage. I mean, we have a lot of customers who are saying it's the recipe you want to change more often, it's the labeling you want to change, you want to make a kind of a special offering. And this is a dynamics which we see from our customers in the market of flexibility they are requesting. It's hard to do that. Even in a fully a non-automated plant, it's super difficult. But the possibilities are there to do that now.
AI's growth is colliding with a very real limitation, which is power. That is true for Siemens. It's true for a number of companies, as we know. How does Siemens help make data centers more efficient from design all the way through operation?
You touched the point. It starts with the design. Whenever we build a new plant, we build it twice. We build it once in a digital world. We optimize it to the very end, each corner. We even optimize the people on the shop floor. So we have a digital twin of people working on the digital twin of a plant. And once we optimized it, then we start sending the excavation machine and build it. And we do the same now for data centers. We optimize data centers. One example is cooling. The next generation of GPUs consumes 300 watt each. You cannot cool them now with air anymore. You have to use liquid cooling. So now what we're optimizing is the whole flow of cooling liquid, then the heat exchanger, giving the heat to the air. We optimize the way we run the connection. So DC, medium voltage, low voltage, how many redundancies you have. So we do that, we optimize it over again, even the controls. These GPUs have a super high transient, so they are consuming very much high energy and low energy in very short time. So you have to control your valves, your cooling valves with industrial PCs. You're simulating everything. And if you go for DC-DC, so currently you have AC coming in, you convert it to DC, so direct current. And this is a lot of losses in between. We want to eliminate that. So therefore, you can switch faster, you can switch more efficiently, you have less losses. And then you optimize the whole system once before you build it. And this can reduce your energy consumption substantially.
Yeah, something that clearly is needed in the debate around data centers.
Absolutely.
Okay, if you get out your crystal ball, 5 years from now, what does winning the industrial AI race look like in the U.S., and what does it take to get there?
5 years from now, you will see a tremendous step up in the models which we're using, in the foundation models. You will see industrial foundation models emerging. These are models which are trained on industrial data, which do similar things what I described, to see much, much more applications. You will see And this is a very interesting thing. You will see much more robots. And it's not only humanoids, but also autonomous robots on the shop floor.
What are they going to look like?
Well, this is the point. This is the point. If you talk to our manufacturing people, they say, I don't need a humanoid. So first thing is they say, take the legs away.
Take the legs away.
Take the legs away because, I mean, if you put a robot on wheels on a shop floor, which is anyhow flat, you can run it. The energy consumption in order to stabilize the robot standing on two legs and make it walk, this is just waste of energy, waste of compute. Why do you need it? Secondly, they say, why does a robot need only two hands and maybe 10 fingers? I need maybe a robot with six hands and two fingers.
It's going to be a really creepy robot.
Absolutely. I tell you. So the point is the humanoids are meant for a world which is designed for humans. So you might find humanoids here in the kitchen in order to clean it up or in the living room.
We'd all be okay with that. Yeah.
That's what you need. But you will see much, much more robots, autonomous robots, which you can really just talk to and they do a job. And hopefully you will see data centers which are running much more efficient, but also which are used in a more efficient way. You will see a lot of inferencing that a lot of semiconductor will go to the shop floor in order to use the models trained in a data center and do the job at the edge. So that's what robots basically do. And I believe for the United States, you see a lot of much, much more own manufacturing in the United States in the sectors I was describing. And more jobs.
Okay, we'll hold you to that in 5 years, bring you back and see how these factories and robots look and what the job situation looks like. Please, everyone, thank you so much, Roland Busch. Give Roland a round of applause. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.